Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 4, Text 17 and 18. You know, I lose track of where I am, especially since I'm teaching this every day here in Vrindavan. But I'll start here. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Bhutikanam cha bhavanam shakti rasam chitakritam asadadanam nisatvam tamedam rasitayushu dvagam chajanam viksha munir divyena chakshusha sarvavarnasramanam yad yadauhitam mamogadrik. The great sage who is fully equipped in knowledge could see through his transcendental vision the deterioration of everything material due to the influence of the age. He could also see that faithless people in general would be reduced in duration of life and would be impatient due to the lack of goodness. Thus he contemplated for the welfare of men in all statuses and orders of life. Om Jnana Timurandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Taksurmutam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Mano Gushtam Tapitam Yena Bhutale Ayamuga Kadamayam Vidati Sapadantikam Ramchakampa Kurujasta Vibhashindu Bayubhaja Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasudeva Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So greetings from Vrindavan. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful Vrindavan. It really is. Once you just scratch the surface, it is the land of love. There's an energy that moves to please God. And it's very, very thick, especially when you leave anyway, wherever you are, if you're not. Today, again, I went to Tatiastan, where that 10 acres is preserved of the original Vrindavan. No electricity. It just ended like 500 years ago. And beautiful forests within that compound. And when you enter, there's such an effect on your consciousness. And the place is unfettered by the the country is made by God, the city is made by man, the poet Cooper. So when it's unfettered by man's creations, God really shines through, and not only God shines through, but his loving energy shines through. But to speak at these, it's really an amazing scene. About 10:30 or something, there's the art teak and the temple room floor, which is outdoors, has about 2 feet thick of brudrage, really clean, to dust the Vrindavan. And, you know, the sadhus, you know, I guess these been there for 60, 70 years, they come out of their little huts in the woods or something, real raggedy, all covered with the brudrage. That's their tilak. They just cover their bodies with the dust of Vrindavan. And they chant in this classical sound. The only frame of reference I have is Gregorian chants. And bhakti, sanjayate bhakti. When you hear bhakti, when you feel bhakti, it awakens in your heart. I'm here in Vrindavan, and I've actually started a new program. I have 2 classes a day because I have such great people that want to learn, really exceptional. And in the morning, I just meet with a few people, and very bright people, so sometimes I ask them what they're thinking at the times, and there's wonderful contributions. Shastra Vichar means to consider the scriptures from different angles and fortify your faith. And not in things that you don't believe, but actually remembering what you do believe and bringing it to the forefront of your consciousness to help you get that determination in Krishna consciousness. And that's where real intelligence comes, because the soul is above the intelligence. So when you really make, and the intelligence comes from the soul. At least according to Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhakti Lok. And when you get become fixed in devotion, a wonderful intelligence comes from your consciousness. The kind of intelligence that just practically tells you what's what and what to do. So, and then we've been studying this chapter of the Bhagavatam here. It's narration. Sukhi Goswami is in answer to the questions of the sages of Namasharanya. There, because it's the beginning of Kali Yuga and Vyas, we'll say, well, like Sukhi Dev, at the beginning of Kali Yuga, it's more or less contemporary, the sages of Namasharanya meeting. And when the Bhagavatam was taught to Vyasadeva, and now Sutta Goswami, who's the Acharya at Namasharanya, has informed the sages that he's going to explain to them the Bhagavatam. We discussed this many, many times, but the point is so relevant. Is really the greatest gift is to hear from someone who's realized the truth. Because that realization, which is a depth of understanding, a depth of understanding that allows one to present what one's understood or present what one's heard that was crafted for one's particular frame of reference. And we craft that message for someone else or some other audience whose mode of understanding is not exactly the same as yours. without losing that. Because there's nothing like a good idea that's spoken with conviction that you can not only understand, but due to the conviction the person speaking can feel the importance of that idea, which increases your desire to fully understand it and embrace it as a component of your own way of seeing the world. There's nothing like that because happiness is dependent on the mind, and the mind is simply composed of your different samskaras, what you like and what you don't like. And the only way to change it is to get a better idea of what you like and don't like. So to hear Shastra in a way that one can assimilate it is really, really the greatest gift. So the sages of Namashranya are more than thrilled when they want to hear about Vyas and Sukadev and Marge Prickett, the players in this story that they're about to hear. And and hear about their fascinating life. So the Shonaka Rishi is asked about that, and Sutta's explaining. They're asking Sutta about these personalities, and now Sutta's explaining about Vyas. And it's talking now about the immensity of the task he has at hand. Because of the lack of education and character of the people that he has to present the Vedas to. And here they're presenting some of the qualities. The deterioration of everything material. And it's interesting, this is spoken thousands of years ago, and it talks about this age as the deterioration of everything material. Can anyone deny that? We can't even get good water from lakes in the ground anymore. How beautiful Vrindavan was even 30 years ago when the Jamuna flowed swiftly near the Prikram path, and I could 15 minutes be in the bank of the Jamuna and dive off the cliffs into its clear water. How beautiful New York was when the Hudson River was clear. I mean, imagine that. If the Hudson River was just clear, sweet water and hadn't been polluted. So there's a deterioration of everything material, and it affects us. It affects us. It affects our health. It affects our concentration. Getting a real piece of fruit. It's funny. It's so hip and cutting edge and great. Things to be organic previously, when things were supposedly less advanced, everything was organic. People were eating organic food. And what to speak of the air. So, and it's not only that, it's not only the objects but it's the character of the people that are deteriorating. I mean, I'm just reflecting. I'm now 64, you know, and I came to Vrindavan when I was 26. You know, almost 40 years ago. And, you know, the character of the people I used to meet, just in terms of their integrity and their determination, you know, how people had these samskaras who died for their word. And that was only 40 years ago, what to speak of 80 years ago. So the sages are seeing this, that everything is being reduced, and people are extremely restless. Because of the and increasingly so, because there's just an overload of sensory input, a natural sensory input in lower modes that's just creating some scars galore to constantly. Our minds are constantly desiring to be fed with distraction. Right now, it's so pathetic that most of us would not know how to live. We would think it's like a hellish planet if there were no computers. But I grew up without computers and social networking. So actually Eric Fromm talked about, you know, the greatest freedom is the freedom from want. So we discussed this before. He has to negotiate now how to present something to people who are not qualified. Later on, it describes that, because as the story goes, you know, Vyasa has a kind of a dissatisfaction in his heart, which really, really surprises him. Because generally, you know, I had a good day today. You know, I had a good day today. And I got up and I chanted for a few hours. And I did my deity worship. And then I had a wonderful shastavichar with about three or four really good people studying shastra. And then, you know, I went out. I took Anand, who came from Moscow, Ananda Govardhan. She came from Moscow just for 2-3 days. And I took her and Alex, who's now my assistant, and we went. We just chanted. Oh, and before I chanted in the morning, I spent about an hour writing, and then we went to the place, we just sat in these trees and chanted and went to their RT, got back, took lunch, took a walk, picked some roses, came back, had a few hours before my class, took a little nap, then began to, you know, write some letters, you know. I felt so good because I was always engaged, and I did, you know, it's a direct correlation. When you're responsible and you utilize your time responsibly, you feel it. You feel a certain satisfaction. And when you don't, you feel a certain dissatisfaction. Dissatisfaction and suffering is generally just an indication that you're not fulfilling responsibly your duties based on your what you're made of and what you're made for, based on your nature, basically. So he's a little bit shocked, you know, what we need, you know, after all the work he did, that he's dissatisfied. And therefore, a, you know, very beautiful point arises. He's sincere, so he tries to search it out. That's what an intelligent person does. He tries to find the cause of the despondency. Correlating the despondency as an indication of something that needs to be improved within one's activities and mode of thinking. So he's sincere, so he searches it out. And that internal search, which is a manifestation of sincerity, is witnessed by God and reciprocated by God. It's like they talk about finding guru. It starts with that search within the heart. You really, really want knowledge, no matter what it means to your life. You want the truth. The truth is heavy, because the truth judges us. The truth says this attachment is an anartha, it's unwanted. And that what you have in your life is unwanted, what you don't have is wanted, it indicates a change. And that change moves against our present way of thinking based on our desires or if you really in your heart open yourself up, I want truth. Now, of course, it doesn't mean, I have to say this many times, renunciation. Because in bhakti, we can embrace our attachments in relationship to God, and therefore they become assistance in the devotional path. It's a very amazing thing. It's a very amazing thing. What was I reading today about karma? It's a very, very amazing thing. But not all. So to open ourselves up, I want truth, no matter what that means to my present mode of thinking. That's spiritual life. Spiritual life really is about that kind of surrender. And therefore, it's a process that has no material prerequisite. Because surrender is a condition of heart that's, and therefore it is accessible no matter what one's condition is. A child can surrender, a genius can surrender, a simple person can surrender, a austere person can surrender, someone who's more indulgent can surrender. it's not a material qualification, but it's still tough. Because although spiritual qualifications are not, do not have that requirement, material requirement, it's still difficult, the application. Put your head on the floor and to be humble. Anyway, it takes a sincere person to want truth. And that's how we actually ultimately find guru. We go into our heart, and there's a transcendental system between the super soul and the guru is the external manifestation of the super soul. So Vyas, he sincerely goes into his heart. He really wants to know what's wrong. He really wants to correct himself. And his guru comes and tells him what was wrong with the presentation he made. And it was that he hadn't sufficiently glorified Krishna. Because here it says in the verse, he contemplated for the welfare of men in all statuses and orders of life. That was his job. You give knowledge because you want to benefit people. Nana shastra vichara naikinipanosa dharma samstapako. Lokanam hitakarana. Because nana shastra vichara naika, they scrutinized and studied all the shastras. Sadharma samstapako. To establish dharma. To establish what are people's duty. What are the things one has to do in the present condition of one's life that are dharma, that will elevate consciousness. So, that's what he had to contemplate. He had to contemplate and contemplate on his audience. And he didn't do it correctly because he didn't do it correctly because he catered so much to materialistic people that he gave more credence in the scriptures to fruitive activities to allure people within a process of sacrifice and socialization. One second, I'll be right back. I have to answer a phone call. Well, no, I don't, I guess. One second, I got it. Okay, I'll be right back. Okay, Ananda, I'm coming. Okay. Okay. Just don't you finish. I'm giving my 7:30 class. Okay, let me get back on track here. So he but not sufficiently enough to presenting the glories of God and surrender. And the reason why it was defective, ironically enough, is because, he gave many, many reasons. One reason is that the nature of the people is if you sanction some enjoyment within the confines of some prohibition, then the nature of people who are not elevated is they will use the sanction and neglect the prohibition. And the example that's given, classic example that's given in the Shastra for that, is of the Lord Buddha. That, not him, but what happened is there's, you know, Vyas made the Vedas. He wanted to accommodate everyone. So he gave some prescription, even to those who were meat eaters, to come and be purified, where there was a certain sacrifice that could be done, where the animal was killed, but in a religious way, where it got some higher destination, and in a way in which it created some scars in your consciousness, against the very activity that you've come to the sacrifice to enjoy. So what happened is historically, at least what's reported historically, is that on the basis that people ran with the sanction, and then on the authority of the Vedas, slaughterhouses were opened within India, which belied the very basis of spirituality. Because spirituality means to control your mind from selfishness. And the grossest selfishness is exploiting others, but to speak of slaughtering others. So without ahimsa, without nonviolence, there really can't be spirituality. So, anyway, people ran with the sanctions and they forgot the prohibitions. So Vyasa's strategy really did more harm than good, although he was very sincere. It did more harm than good. But there's another reason that was given also. That you have to be, to really understand the absolute truth, that there's Upanishadic sections also in the Vedas. To really understand the absolute truth, you have to be chakshana. That means you have to be very expert, nana shastra vicharanaika. You have to have a scrutinizing mind. And you have to be, nisattva sukham. You have to be without the desire for material happiness. So on the path of karma leading to Gyan, you have to be detached. So because the people of this age can never understand the absolute truth in that way. They needed something that required less material qualification. Now, this is the ironic thing. The highest thing requires less material qualification. Because the highest thing is to surrender to God and to want to hear the superiority of something you're connected with that's greater than yourself. That's the exact opposite of material consciousness. Material consciousness is envy. It's not wanting anything above yourself and wanting to move yourself above everything else. It plagues even spiritual movements. I was reading in this Bhakti Loka, the desire for reputation destroys spiritual life. Desire to be seen as great or superior, it ruins spiritual life. And that's what fruit of activities are about. It's about envy. I want to be more beautiful, more wealthy, more of this. It's envy. It's simply ichidveshasamutena dvandvamohenabha. We're born into this world, overcome with the dualities of desire and hate. It's simply like that. So, the qualification of a devotee is simple, and only qualification is that he's free from envy. Which means humility. It's the same. Humility. You embrace the concept of something greater than yourself, which you can worship, adore, and love. You embrace the concept that authority for what we should be doing does not rest within ourselves. It rests in something higher than ourselves. One embraces that. So, the highest thing doesn't have the material qualifications. So in an age where people are lacking those qualifications, the only way in which they can elevate their consciousness is to glorify God and be happy small in relationship to the divine. And that's an effective process of self-realization. It just requires humility. And ironically, the benefit of this Kali Yuga is that with some inspiration and spiritual knowledge, we actually have a chance to become humble, because we don't have much to be proud of. Therefore, in the Bhakti Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami says, devotion in the form of kirtan is unlimitedly merciful to those devoid of the sense of false prestige. Devotion in the form of kirtan is unlimitedly merciful to those devoid of the sense of false prestige. And he said, therefore, this age is favorable because our qualities are reduced. We have less to be proud of if we can reflect on it. It's just like In the 12-step process, the first thing is to consider yourself helpless. That's the beginning of spiritual life. And your lack of qualification then becomes the greatest qualification. When I asked Giriraj Swami once, how did you get so much of Prabhupada's mercy? It's not just the mercy gaze. Your lack of qualification becomes your qualification. If you can be humble. Because then you can surrender to God. Janmaishvarya Shuddha Shri Bir Edamana Madhapuna Navahantabi Taifun. One who is intoxicated with high class, birth, opulence, education, beautiful women. One's intoxicated, then unless one is akinchina, understands that we're nothing, that everything is given by God. The inspiration to do things and the things that we have in themselves are all given by God. So ironically, this particular age is most suited for the direct process of devotional service. And in previous ages, where people had so much more qualification, like in Satyuga, people could be so disciplined. They can meditate for 60,000 years, but the weakness of that is that when they look at something which is just is not arduous, they don't have much respect for it. They don't really have so much respect for kirtan. It's just too simple. So, you know, Vyasa is told, you should glorify God. And you should use your goodness and your realization to do that effectively. Because hearing God will inspire one to love and surrender to God. And when you surrender, all your problems are finished. Because all our problems are due to the imposition of the modes of nature, which only follow us because we don't want to be part of God. We don't want to surrender to God. And because what we are is in relationship to God, to satisfy that desire to be something which we are not, which is the enjoyer and controller, it has to be fulfilled within the context of an energy that puts one into illusion. So when you embrace who you are, love who you are, understand who you are, I am part of God and I'm meant for God's service, and therefore I surrender to that will, as it's represented by those who have surrendered to God and therefore have understood that will. And when you do that, then you have nullified or reverse the cause of all material existence, which is a desire to be what we're not, which is unsurrendered to the will of God, unconnected to the will of God. So, somehow or other, Vyas made some kind of strategy, but it was so defective. It was so defective. People would get confused by it. And rather than moving them towards the goal, it would be a stumbling block towards the goal. So therefore, take advantage of the Kali Yuga Vyas, where people have no recourse other than surrender to God, and have no other abilities than the cultivation of humility based on an unfortunate situation. Yeah, I'm going to stop right now, but I got to get out of the presentation mode.
Maharaj? Swamiji?
Yeah, Moody. Hi, Bo. Yeah, great to hear
you. Pronounce. Thanks for another great class, Maharaj. It's always really inspiring. I'm outside right now, and I have a little headpiece in, so if the sound is bad
it's
on your
okay.
side, please.
I hear you great.
Well, I wanted to ask you, earlier in the discussion you were talking about the way in which our lives right now are difficult and more difficult in many ways than people's lives were in the past, because the natural things we experience have been are often corrupted or in some way subpar. And I guess I wanted to ask you for your reflections on the fact that there's ways where it's almost surprising, because how to put this, like, you know, you get the sense of what does it mean for things to become degraded. You imagine things like famines, or you imagine things like, you know, just like a loss of natural materials. And yet the way that our world is, it's almost like we're becoming degraded because of greater ability to conquer the natural world and to control the world. You know, like in other words, you know, my children are going to have a much harder time learning how to just have a basic, they're going to have a harder time developing the skill of remembering than I did, because I had to memorize phone numbers, for example. And I'm having a harder time than my grandmother did, because she had to, she would write people letters, and therefore she had to concentrate in that way, as opposed to something like email or a phone call. So I guess I'm asking you for your reflections on how it's not obvious the way that the world's getting worse, because it's almost like we're being tricked into thinking it's getting better. I'm really just asking for your musings on.
We are being tricked to think it's getting better, but I know that when I grew up, right, only my father had to work, and my mother could stay home and take care of the kids, right?
Yeah.
And that was much more common, you know. Father knows best. Leave it to Beaver. You know.
yeah.
It was much more common. So, you know, and it's certainly now, you know, there was a period like a boom or something, maybe there's a little bump there, but the standard of living is going down, you know? I mean, many, many things, you know? And then, you know, in one sense, sometimes, you know, okay, America is kind of getting, you know, but it's you know, there's always people that do a little bit better in terms of exploiting others, you know what I'm saying, to take their resources to live in a better way. But, you know, it's just, yeah, I mean, it's, you can't look at things as just like, you know, 100 years or something like that, you know. But definitely, I just see, I mean, I'm just wondering, what, you know, clean water, clean air, community, you know, so many things. I guess, the technology that you're mentioning, you know, I just wonder really how much. I mean, what is it actually? The point is, what is it actually enabling people to do?
Right.
It's Maya Sukaya, you know. Like, I grew up in America. You know, I knew everyone on the block. You know, everyone on the block was like family. You know, now you have this great access to contact people all over the world, but you never get to actually sit down with anyone. So it's kind of I mean, if I want to look at it objectively, yeah, I mean, there were some things back then that maybe were worse and things like that. But I even question, even in terms of, you know, the type of these, it's almost like one in every three people get cancer now. I think there's some fact like that, you know?
Yeah.
You think about it. How many people get cancer? Heart disease. So, excuse me. Yeah, listening, yeah.
I was just going to agree with you. I saw a headline this morning that the children are exposed to a variety of debilitating chemicals now at an unprecedented rate. And I'm sure many of these things are part of what we take to be advancements. I was just agreeing with you, basically. Could I follow up with this, though, with a kind of apparent challenge that I admit I find troubling? I think, as you know, I'm extremely sympathetic to this way of seeing things, extremely. I personally find it very hard to negotiate sometimes the way in which I do think we have some advances compared to the past, but they tend to be mixed with a lot of mistakes where we get rid of good things, you know? So just for example, I'm genuinely grateful to live in a world where my daughters can't be objectified sexually, and that's just part of the world. Now, maybe they are objectified in other ways, I grant that. But at least, like, if they apply for a job, the boss can't somehow just make some sexual advance at her, and she has to say, well, this is part of getting a job, right? They're protected in that way.
Right.
So to my mind, that's a good advance. And you and I love classical India, but India, unfortunately, is pretty bad in this regard. Somehow or other, that's been lost.
Right.
That protecting. And yet, that's a good thing. And yet, it also comes along with, as you said, this idea that to have a good life, everyone has to have a job. So that means the husband and wife both work, so you outsource raising the kid to a nanny or something, which is hard to do. So I guess I'm asking you,
I think what you're mentioning is, to a certain extent, a solution perhaps to a problem that's been created, you know, in relationship to, for example, in relationship to women, you know?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? In terms of like sexual harassment or something like that, I don't know what it would be like in a classical culture, you know, where you know, people grew up with mothers at home and no divorce and kind of a respect for ladies, perhaps, you know? I'm just wondering how much of the advancement is just a reaction to problems being caused, you know, by the deterioration of the age.
And so, in other words, I guess what you're suggesting is that sometimes when these traditional relationships are abused, are you suggesting it's a mistake to think that represents the classical culture? That's already a deviation. And so to think that you're advancing... No, please.
I think two things. One, it's kind of like, hierarchical social systems are effective. You know what I'm saying? Where, a father has authority over their children, for example. But the very thing that's built into the social structure that's advantageous, when the culture is lost, becomes a facility for abuse. So, in the Bhagavatam, what it describes is that Kali Yuga enters when Shringi curses Maharaj Cricket, and he's a young boy, and he has power, but no culture. So, when there's no culture, and people have power, there's abuse. So, there's going to be abuse, and people will blame it on previous structures, right, that actually were effective in social organization. Like, a family structure where there's some decision-making, process rather than people just fighting, but they'll blame it on that structure, but actually the problem is the lack of culture and something like that.
Well, I really appreciate your point, Marge. In fact, and again, I don't want to monopolize the conversation, and you may be tired.
Well, please. We haven't heard you for a while, so I like this.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Marge, it does strike me, and I really appreciate you putting it in these terms, that, when I try to reflect on evil, what does it mean to be evil versus what does it mean to be good, in a very basic way, to be a good person means to not exploit the power you have over others. And it seems to me that that's not, it's not easy to do sometimes because power over another person is extremely, it's extremely hard to recognize sometimes the extent of power we have over others. And so in a way, someone like Prabhupada, for example, for Prabhupada to be a good person, he was tested more than I am. Why? Because he had so much more resources and people that he affected. Right? It's a lot easier to not hurt anyone if you don't actually influence anyone. And so at the same time, to have power over someone else and not abuse it for your purposes requires at minimum it requires decency. And in a higher level it requires seeing your power as a vehicle for something better than you or greater than you. And I guess, Marge, what I'm thinking about in relation to your comments is that you can change political structures, and that might help alleviate abuse of power. But unless individuals are actually becoming cultured and transformed, there's going to be exploitation, right? So I think a good example historically would be something like communism. Communism was supposed to have been founded out of the spirit to overcome the abuses done to the working class. But if you just change the political structure without changing people's culture, then the people who are now the managers within the communistic system are just going to abuse other people. You know what I mean? So, I'm trying to think about it in relation to this class. Is that there's really no substitute for doing the inner work that's required to turn ourselves toward God, and maybe people who reject the traditional systems, the traditional way of seeing things, are not appreciating that if you really are doing that work we all have to do, then the beauty of that system becomes more evident, perhaps, and the sanity
right.
of that system.
And if you're not, it becomes a vehicle for more harm.
Yeah.
But then the advancement, right, as you say, the advancement is not just changing the system, right? The advancement would be to embrace the consciousness that was guiding that system before it was being abused, you know?
Right.
And if you do that, then you'll have other systems. I mean, it's kind of like Buddha, that, you know, he rejects the Vedas. It's not that the Vedas were bad. It's just that they were being abused, right? So the ultimate solution is not to reject the Vedas, but to have someone reestablish it more along its original purposes. So, something like that.
Well, thanks, Marge. It was a lot of inspiring things to think about.
Yeah, it was nice. Well, I'm just... In India, somehow or other, it's harder to give the evening classes because India somehow winds down a lot sooner than America, you know. So it's, but it's great here. I mean, it's really, I mean, I can't speak more highly enough about Daven, the Krishna Bala Mandir. It's, the level of kirtan is just increasing. It's just amazing. At any time of the day, the quality of the people. So nice, just walking, running into Dina Bandhu, and, you know, just so many stalwarts and devotion, and the quality. You know, I'm right now, in the morning, I don't know if you ever heard this book called Bhakti Lok by Bhaktivinoda Thakur.
Yes, I read it years ago. It's a really wonderful book. It's very powerful.
It's phenomenally good. And, you know, I just have a few people, and I read it, and I get my realization, and they have comments. Really bright people. Well-behaved, you know, but really bright. Intellectually deep, independent thinkers. So it's kind of a meeting, really, kind of amazing people. So I just, one lady, she was... she was the head of a, she was a project manager of a publishing company, and then began to search for God, and then wound up with a pretty good guru in South India, like a smarter Brahmin, but at least a smarter Brahmin, you know? I mean, he was a good guy, you know, for his culture, you know? And she trained, and she got a lot of training, but, you know, just somehow had some touch with bhakti, and just you know, people like this just coming to Vrindavan and hearing the Shastra, and so many sincere people. Anyway, I'm probably a little bit delirious now. We'll just see if anybody's still on. They can say hello, and I'll finish. But
well,
I need
thanks,
to call
thanks,
you
Robert.
Soon and just touch base. And
anytime,
I definitely
anytime.
Plan on visiting your way this year, because I have an assistant, a really nice person that could drive me, which is one of the reasons I just don't travel so much. And also, there's people in that area that are very interesting, guy. That you're not far from Rhode Island, right?
No.
Okay.
About 45 minutes.
Okay, all right, well. Anybody else like to say hello? Anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. This is Gail.
Gail, Hare Krishna. Thank you.
Are you really too delirious for a simple question?
Not for a simple one, but I'm gonna judge whether it's simple or not.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
You remember when you were saying that anybody can surrender despite his qualifications? You know, he's
right.
Smart, he's dumb, he's rich, he's poor.
Yeah.
And you also said even if a person is indulgent, and so I took that to mean that even if you are an indulgent kind of person, you contrasted that with a sincere person. So even though you are an indulgent person, you can surrender because you can have the sincere desire to become less indulgent. Right? Is that it?
Yeah. There's a verse that Bhaktivinoda Thakur quotes again that, you know, if you have the right goal, right?
Yeah.
If you have the right goal, you know, you really... It's funny how he talked about a devotee can
joy, sense gratification, and because he realizes its insignificance.
Mm-hmm.
Bhaktivinoda Thakur said that.
Mm-hmm.
Where a karmi can't.
Yes.
They value it.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And I think what Bhaktivinoda was talking about, it's just kind of like someone's a devotee and he has a family, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Krishna's given him, a family. See, he can love his family, right?
Mm-hmm.
He can love his family because Krishna gave him his family, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, he'll realize that it's not the ultimate truth, you know?
Yeah.
It's just like sometimes you see an Indian family. They don't get mental, right? They have their families and their... But at the same time, by their samskar, they know that there's something higher.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
So Bhaktivinoda Thakur is describing, you know, as long as you have the goal in mind and you may not be able to control yourself completely, you know,
mm-hmm.
but if you understand the goal and you understand in a humble way, you can still take devotion. But the example I wanted to give is just something different. Bhakti is a person who is neither too attached or too detached. Because if you're too detached, you're not going to be interested in the activities of bhakti. And if you're too attached, you're not going to be interested in the activities of bhakti.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't mean indulgent in that way. But not too detached. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes that, so you know, that there's so many things. But if you're a devotee, you know, things come your way as a devotee because you're trying to take care of your needs and things and certain amount of sense enjoyment is in your life, which is required for you to be peaceful. The devotee doesn't get mental about it at all. You know, he can still just fully surrender to Krishna. This is what Krishna gave me. You know, okay, this is what I need to be peaceful. Then you surrender to Krishna. Okay, something like that, Gail. Okay?
Yeah, you see everything, you see and do everything in light of the goal, basically.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm. But while you're enjoying it, you're not maybe not thinking so much. You're not mental, you know. You know, you're just not mental. Big feast comes, you're not, you know, okay, you take some nice prasad. You know, okay, thank you, Gil. Anybody
thank
else
you.
Like to say hello?
Hari Bol Maharaj, Chaitanya Priya.
Hi, Hari Bol, Chaitanya Priya, thank you.
I have a couple questions. Is it possible to email you?
I think
not
email me because right now.
Can you email?
Yeah,
can I email you?
Yeah, please do. Please do. And send
what
your
is
phone
your
number. If I DDS, like a dentist, at wavesofdevotion.com.
Oh, yes. Okay. Then I have that. All right. I will.
Okay. And if either I'll email you or I'll call you. Okay, thank you.
That's great.
Anybody,
sounds great.
Anybody else like to say hello?
Hi, Krishna Guru Maharaj. This is Kishori Radha.
Great. Kishori Radha. Hari Bol.
Hari Bol.
We'll see you so soon. And it was such a pleasure to see you in Vrindavan, even if for a day.
Nice. Thank you.
Thank you. Good. Anybody
looking
else
forward
like
to
say
you.
Hello? Yeah. Anybody else?
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Henry, Hari Bol. See you in March. Looking forward to it. Okay.
Hari Bol Maharaj, Malati.
Malati, Hari Bol.
Hari Bol.
Great.
Okay. Thank you for class.
We'll keep in touch. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. Good. Anybody else? Okay, we'll end now.